Jones, he married Mabel, a wise old owl was he. He told his wife he never drank a stronger thing than tea. But after honeymooning, at night he stayed away. And for a week he never got home till the break of day. At last poor Mabel asked the reason why. Said Jones, I'm going to tell the truth or die.
Hello, and welcome back to our podcast, where fanfic synthesis follows the popular game about a post-apocalyptic wasteland and My Little Pony, a popular show about pastel horses. Hi, I'm Fi. I'm joined once again with my co-host, Weird. Say hello, Weird.
Now, I know that we've had some dalliances with exotic titles recently, but that is no excuse for you to go back to pure informality. I am Sir Weirdington Esquire.
Yes, hello again. We're back to the OG Weird, because we have completed the Thunderhead arc. It's finally past us.
It is done. The work is complete.
The worst part of the entirety of the book is behind us. At least the worst I remember. Who knows?
And it ended on a wet fart.
Of course it did. Every book ends on a wet fart.
This one especially so. No, like the others have ended with the catastrophic death of the protagonist. Like, yes. let's recount the ways in which the books have ended. We've had two other book endings so far, right? Three other book endings. So the first book ended with Blackjack dying of an explosion, a fall from a tower, and all of the cancers.
No, that was the second book. The first book was the gunfight against Deus.
So the second book created the trend of Blackjack must die at the end of every episode.
Blackjack must die.
Turned every book from then forth into the early episodes of Aeon Flux. Deep cut for animation fans out there, I guess.
Yes.
No, I will not explain myself. You find out. You figure it out. You have the internet. You're listening to this.
Yeah. Go look it up.
Aeon Flux. Liquid Television. Yeah, so the first book just sort of closed as far. I have no idea what sort of we killed Deus and everyone looked around and sort of shrugged in book. Second book, ultra cataclysmic. It's a hell of an ending of a book. Really ought to be the ending of a story. And they're I don't know. It felt well put together compared to modern times. Yeah. the line is just sort of increasingly dwindled. After that, it was a perfunctory time ran out. Souls ripped from your body.
Yep, your soul explodes.
Which is almost cute in that it defies the sort of standard, it's a pretty Saturday morning cartoon ticking clock sort of thing, to ultimately not get resolved, and the protagonist dies. But that really did have a feel, I recall that having a feel of whoop-whoop-a-doop, dead.
Yep.
And this one is, so far the most anticlimactic death for our protagonist. Yay, we win! Rock falls. A rock falls on her.
Rock falls, everyone dies. Yeah,
we're getting ahead of ourselves, I guess. Spoilers,
I was gonna say,
for the end of the episode.
Yeah, I was gonna reinforce kind of how these book recaps work, because we've done a couple of these now, but it's always good to touch base on how these work. Book recaps are always far more mellow and just kind of us converge and talk about points that we haven't really that I feel like we kind of touched on in the chapters, but through my own incessant need to try to keep most of the stuff textual, we don't have a lot of time usually per episode to sit down and talk about all of the faults of a particular part of the work. So this is always a fun one to just kind of talk about the thing and then sort of how where we're going forwards and all that stuff.
But we always we open up with any episode, a recap wherein we have to. But this is a special recap because it's a book recap where we have to work together, put our heads together to try and figure out what precisely the fuck happened across the book.
we have to fusion dance our way into this one.
But anyway, yeah, so on the subject of deaths and previous books' endings, this book opens up with the protagonist's entire essence being obliterated.
Yes.
We're drifting through orb space. This one opens up with Blackjack having at last become at one with Orb. No, wait, again. I forgot that, like, she visits here periodically. She became one with the Orb the last time she died. But this time we get some setup, or what should be setup, for the true final antagonist at the center of Goose Dipsburg. The soul-leading god that lives at the center of the city power plant.
Yeah, the Hoofington Grand Metropolitan Area.
So we find that out, and then our hero is ass-pulled back to life.
Yes, Snails, the other necromancer in our story, has the power to, like, hook souls back together and does so.
But in the most frustrating way possible, because, like, if you do edgy consequences, this is an opportunity for among the edgiest. Rainbow Dash is, Blackjack is now a lich, essentially. An undead thing tethered to a pseudo-living body.
But to cut it short, like, there's no consequences of it. She has no, like...
She's just alive.
Yeah, she does not have, like, the phlactris problem, like, issue, nor is she, like, a ghoul of any kind.
She's just alive again, and we get some, like, hand waves. We're told that it's painful. We're told that it was in an uncomfortable process, but beyond that, no meaningful consequences for this particular death, which is really a sign of diminishing returns. Then when we last left her in the previous book, having her soul eviscerated, she was also in a tower that was going to, like, explode with multiple leftover pre-war.
Yeah, but that was last book. Go watch our last podcast. Potovision.
I guess to accelerate it, like, that didn't happen for no reason. Yeah. That just didn't happen. The zombie town that was supposed to be the stakes for that happening is fine. For God's sake, he wraps up a murder mystery that was
in the previous
fucking book
as like an afterthought too. Like, something I want to get out of the way, like, because this is going to be a longer episode in general. I didn't really think about it until I was, like, looking through my notes again. There is a lot to cover here, because, like, a lot of fucking shit happened to this book. But, like...
All nonsense. All of it pointless.
Yes, it's unconnected. Like, it's a lot of, like... Like, we talked about this a lot in book three, about how, like, the second half of book three... feels like a lot of unconnected short story that Somber wanted to tell, and that carries over into book four, where the first half of this book feels a lot like a lot of unconnected stories that were just short ideas that Somber wanted to get out before eventually dawdling to get to Thunderhead, because
In some fairness, I'm looking, that's definitely how it felt, but looking back through, like, I'm scrolling through my phone looking at the episode list, and there were three arcs. There are three stories this book.
Oh, there's more than that. There's a couple more than that, though, if you remember.
So the ones that I'm looking at, the ones that I'm getting from just scrolling through the episode titles and descriptions, is that we go from cleaning up the entire last book to visiting that town and being introduced to Dawn, and having the single well-written chapter of the book.
Yeah, I've got a point about that. We're gonna get into it when we get into it.
So I guess mark that down as a point of conversation once I'm done with, like, my broad recap. Fighting through my ADHD to cut down on details and just broad recap. Let's clean up the less book. Followed by the introduction. And what seems like the introduction of new high stakes and the introduction of a new bad guy.
And like a great new bad guy. Like their initial presentation is fantastic. Like it may be the best villain intro we get in the whole book. The whole of PH.
And it really sets up what you think is going to be the end of the book. Like you think that that's going to lead into the core. But nope. Then we get a brief interlude where Blackjack gets the shit kicked out of her by the zebra legate.
Yes.
Then we transition to Slavery Town. We visit Hades Town. It's on a golf course, and it's miserable.
Sorry, I just want to take a second. There was a joke in one of my notes that didn't make it into the actual episode. I just really want to talk about it. For some reason, please. I wrote down Mr. Ed 209. And that makes me really laugh. in relation to Blackjack.
Oh, okay, we're gonna get to that. I'll make sure to repeat it at the appropriate time. So yeah, the fucking society is a miserable mess for a thousand reasons. And that, incidentally, he wipes his ass with everything that was set up in the previous short story collection, the previous arc, the setting up Dawn. He wipes his ass with that real quick before taking us to Thunderhead,
which,
and know, it was every bit the rip snorer that I thought it was going to be. Not lots of sort of fascist apologia. With the sort of hilarious disavowal that they are the current antagonists, except when they're not. Whereupon Blackjack is finally converted into Mr. Ed. Somber proves our theory that we developed when Dawn was shit canned after Blackjack was inexplicably had the shit kicked out of her by the legate and light hose, that he just will not allow like a woman to beat up a man. Blackjack did wind up beating light hose, but only after like Somber had to set up. He was sick that day, and also the zombie. The 300-year-old zombie of one of the main six softened him up for her.
And the sun was in his eyes, and like, yeah.
And then she falls, and then a rock falls on her.
And then she does a cool thing and triggers a mega spell, and then a ship falls on her and probably, like, theoretically knocks her into the core.
If you wanted to, like, kill her again... Like, just the logic of the mega spell she used would have been fine. She's trapped at the center of a gravity well. Like, there's no escape. It would have been a heroic... It would have been a thing where she, once again, like, heroically destroys herself. For the It would be a repeat of firing the atrocity gun at the Apocalypse Tower. It has to be lamer than that. Somber is philosophically dedicated to being as... lame as shit as possible. So anyway, what was the note you had for I think you were saying that the thing that you really wanted to talk about, let's start with the first sub arc, the first story, the Dawn introduction.
Yes. So yeah, I have all my points, my pinned points, as I like to do in these recaps. So the first one, the one I'm gonna title Dawn, the best and worst villain. We touched on a little bit on this recap, and we talked a lot about it during the actual chapter. How much we like how much I like. At least I don't know necessarily Weird's feelings about it, but like I really liked Dawn. I think Dawn's introduction as a dumb, like, Blackjack gets dark mirrors all the goddamn time, and it gets pretty tedious. But like Dawn is the only one that feels like she actually like sells that concept, and
yeah,
she's the character.
Earns it.
Yeah, she was a character that was foreshadowed for a super long time to be like, oh, she's like this weird humanitarian who like, you know, got fed up with the system and flew away, and she's like been missing for decades. And for her to come back and the fact that she has been like utterly, utterly radicalized towards like oblivion, basically. Like,
oh man, big feels. big mood.
But she like took the wrong lesson from it. Like she went like, we need radical hierarchical structure. We need bigger boots. We don't need the removal of boots. We need a god to fix this. It's the only way. And like that's a really like interesting character arc, and she parallels Blackjack really nicely with a lot of her characterization. And like the fact that like, so like we talk about this a lot too, about how like one of the worst problems with this story is that villains have your typical villain speeches, which is, you know, very common for this kind of story and just stories in general, obviously. But usually when a villain says something, the hero then refutes it. They don't necessarily say they refute it, but they like refute it by their core being. Like it's the spiral energy will destroy the universe, and then they just go fuck that and punch them with a drill. Like
the counter argument in Gurren Lagann, which I don't think was like adequately like articulated, but it's basically, but what kind of existence is that? Things should be allowed to end.
So in the case that Dawn has become this like crazy like radical nightmare, and that she is refuted like very well too by Blackjack, is like genuinely shocking of both of their characters. Like to have Blackjack just like effortlessly just like tear down like this monster's just poisonous rhetoric is fantastic. It's a wild, deliberate execution of character to the point where we're convinced that this was written by someone else. Like this was
completely 1,000% convinced. Like I cannot square everything that happened in that chapter with like Somber.
And even in that chapter, the stakes were like upped by like it's she is also like the logical conclusion of Blackjack's like, you know, like road to cyberhood. Like I don't agree with the concept that prosthetics makes you evil, but one of the themes of this story is that like cyber modification is like a byproduct of like becoming a monster. So the idea that Dawn is superficially less cybernetic than Blackjack, only to reveal that she is theoretically 100% a cyborg now, is a really cool moment.
I think in the same way that in the original cyberpunk stories, cyberization is framed as a bad thing because it's the metaphor is becoming a object, is becoming a tool of like capitalism, is becoming a physical embodiment of the industrial replacement of the human being. And I think whoever wrote, like, I am 1,000% convinced that Simer didn't write this. I think whoever wrote this really did a good job of doing what, like, I think I made some sort of reference or joke pretty early on when we were making Blackjack is becoming unto a gun half jokes. I think that's kind of the metaphor that Dawn like sort of embodies, like making a good use of the idea that cyberization makes you crazy. It might not be that cyberization makes you crazy, but becoming a gun makes you crazy.
It's sacrificing everything, including yourself, for the purposes of ending your goal
of violence, of solving things through violence, becoming a creature that can only solve things through violence, because every bit of you is replaced with weaponry.
And she does this in this big dramatic moment of severing her familiar ties by like impaling her husband and like promising that there's no more excuses now, is like a really cool moment. That is a moment that really stuck with me. But like the shitty thing about it is that like I think that like Somber then took over and ruined the character by like, because I've talked about this before, I went through and like re-listened to all our book recaps, and I talked about how like one of the things I really touched on a lot was the idea of like reactive storytelling, the idea that like it always feels like Somber is trying to like respond to his critics directly by like fixing his story by just amending details. And I could very easily see it that people don't like Dawn because, I mean, like she's a woman and like therefore she has undeserved power, but like also just the idea that like she's too strong for Blackjack, so how's she possibly going to be able to fight her? Like, if Blackjack is just, like, a street samurai and Dawn is the goddamn Necron Queen, like, how are they possibly going to be able to tango? And then, like, the first time they actually fight, like, Blackjack just readily tears her apart.
And also, she, like, fights her too early in a bizarre context. Yeah, like this whole story is very obviously written from chapter to chapter, and maybe he has, like, some big ideas that are brewing in the back of his head that he doesn't commit to paper until it's time to write the current chapter. Yeah, I can kind of see people making that kind of extremely dumb argument, which is very similar to, like, oh man, Darth Vader's so overpowered, how can Luke possibly confront him? Well, he doesn't. Keep watching the story. Like, that's a very good question, dear reader. I'm glad you're excited to know the answer. Please tune in to find out. Like, gibberish nonsense. How can Indiana Jones face off against the entire Nazi army?
I just also want to, like,
failure.
I do want to take just 1 second to talk about that. I do kind of love that, for all of the faults of Star Wars, I do love that Luke defeats his father through radical compassion rather than, like, becoming a stronger weapon. That's just something that just dawned on me.
No, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Like, how can hero fight antagonist? Antagonist is far too strong. That certainly is a head thing you got going there. That is certainly was a brain thought you did.
Yeah, it's almost as if stories are, like, intentionally permeated with underdogs because we enjoy watching them triumph despite their weaknesses. It's not fun watching a character effortlessly curb stop their next villain, like, literally the second time they see them. But I think it's partly because they kind of also blew their load too early, because, like, Somber is a person who's, like, very one-dimensional as writing of characters, so, you know, Dawn gets this big pop, and then they're like, okay, well, what do we do with her now? Like, she can't, like, she has no other thing to do, like, she's just there to be, like, a giant screaming harpy to fight.
Fucking final boss!
Yeah, I know. But yeah, that was the thing I wanted to get into, though, is that so someone brought this up on the Discord server, that, like, it's how this story so gear shifts and transitions from this all being about Dawn to being about Lighthooves. Like, Lighthooves could be completely replaced by Dawn in this arc, and it would have been fine. Like, if you just had her show up, and she's like, you know, I'm Dawn, and, like, she's just she's back in her normal skin, and, like, she's a Pegasus, and everyone loves her because she's, like, a weird, like, you know, cultural icon, and she's this weird, like, Mother Teresa figure, and
she's bringing resources up from her harbingers.
Yeah,
these silver rings that will massively enhance the lightning guns protecting the city. We sure are excited to test out all these lightning guns with these mysterious metal silver rings installed in them.
Exactly.
Shit, come to think of it, yeah, no, that never actually occurred to me. Like, you could actually, like, kick light hooves into like a second tier set, like being a major player in the events. Like, he's had, like, he's been building up heel heat for a while, and it would be worthwhile to have him there, but, like, the primary antagonist of this arc could have been, should have been, very easily Dawn. Because like, all the people of the City of Thunderhead, like, know her. There's a lot of reason to trust her, and she has nefarious, like, it's next door! It's next door to the goddamn final boss stage, where she lives!
Yeah, they're just, above the final dungeon, yeah. They live on top of Lavos. And, yeah, and it very easily could have been a situation where, like, okay, like, well, then how do you get to the core? You just have the final fight be a thing where they just both, like, take each other to the sky and are just hit by the boat at the end, and that's how we end up in the core. But yeah, it's just, yeah, like, Lighthooves is, like, you can have Lighthooves in it, and it would have been very easy to, like, Lighthooves would have been a great secondary antagonist to have, because, like, you know, you should, like, glory should have mattered more in this chapter, because both of these characters, like, hurt glory in different ways, with, like, Dawn, like, betraying everything that matters to glory, and Lighthooves being a, like, sort of like
conspiring to bleach her.
Yes, and him being like the true face of the Enclave. Like this is the real, like this is the wake up call about how the Enclave actually operates.
Yeah, this straight up just should have been like the Fallen's entire chapter. Like this is like her spotlight. But that's impossible because characters aren't allowed spotlights. Like the closest we got was, oh yeah, there was an incidental subplot that like a lot of ink was spilled over of like fucking Rampage and like fixing Rampage.
Yeah.
And all the character assassination attached to that. I'd blessedly forgotten that. But
yeah, we also gotta talk about Lacuna at some point too. That happened.
Oh, fuck, that happened. That was how this book opened. No,
well,
no,
it wasn't how it opened.
It was the bridge between the
society and
arc and Thunderhead proper. God damn it.
But yeah, so I think we're mostly good on Dawn. Like we've kind of always covered how disappointed we are with Dawn as a character. She gets really like she gets really overwritten and fridged all the time, and the only like argument, like the only logic to me to it, is just comes down to like a subconscious like disgruntlement with women having no interest in writing stories about them, you know, because girl brains are hard. Remember that. I guess we can talk about Lacuna now, though. Because the thing we kind of sort of talk about in the recap, but it's because it's such a like shift in setting. That it could be easy forgiven to have been like assumed to be a fever dream or some sort of like joke being played on our expense.
And it was so detached from literally everything else.
Yeah, but it's also like the thing that I brought this up during the chapter too. The problem with it though is that it's the beating core. It's like the beating heart of this entire story. In my opinion, it's the reason when the entirety of Project Horizons was written was to write this scene. Because to recap, during the events of book three and four, I think mostly four, it's revealed that Blackjack has been corrupted enough by tumors that she now has she's become Wi-Fi.
She's connected to the Wi-Fi. Yeah, she's become Wi-Fi enabled, and the server admin is the goddess.
Yes, and we find it eventually that Lacuna like did that to her. Which sucks because it makes Lacuna like far more of a monster than previously established. But she did that to her because she was like, she like put some of her trauma into Blackjack to cope with it. But because of this, during the events of the original story, when when the goddess is about to be killed by Little Pip, Blackjack was of course also there, hanging in the background.
And Ultra Guy was there to see Superman get punched by Doomsday, but he didn't intervene because he wanted Superman to learn a lesson about hubris.
BJ and Lacuna literally travel out of the plot to go deal with this plot point.
Out of the plot, out of the entire fucking setting.
I was told later that apparently, like, I don't remember if I brought this up in the episode, but apparently there was a disagreement with one of the editors about this, with the expressed consent, like sentiment of do not do this. Like, they thought it was such a bad idea that they spoke up, and apparently like that like absolutely burned that bridge between that editor
I guess this is why none of his editors were storied. None of his editors like did work because it like it's that fucking Boondocks episode with the entitled rapper character and like one dude and his crew like provides constructive criticism and he's out. You're banished.
It's hard to be a like story editor when like the sword is always dangling over your head, and you can be axed at any time and immediately replaced by another copy editor that's willing to lick the boot a little bit harder. This scene was always going to be in it, because of course the reason why this scene exists is so that Somber can take pissy snipes at the original story for not going the way he wants it to. Like, I don't know if I've ever brought this up in the story, like in the context of the podcast, but like one of the like. Maybe I did in the chapter. It's hard to remember. We've done a lot of episodes, folks. One of the things that Somber always said about Full Equestria that he didn't like is he didn't like that little Pip wasn't, like, violently raped during the story, and he felt that that was unrealistic, which really speaks volumes to why it happens so goddamn often in Project Horizons, because it's not about darkness, it's not about telling an edgier story, it's to Somber's, I believe, tell a narratively convincing or realistic, with air quotes, version of a post-apocalyptic wasteland about pastel horses, is to include violent rape. Otherwise, it's inauthentic.
It is impossible in Somber's mind for a woman to travel alone in a wilderness environment in a savage land without inevitably being raped.
Yes, that seems to be the case. So that's why everything seems to happen the way it does in the story. But in this particular context, little Pip nukes the goddess to kill her, and in the chapter, Somber spends a bunch of time hand-wringing over the idea that, like, oh, well, I don't know, she kind of could have handled that in a different way, and it's like, no, like, the thing that really is established in the original story is that, like, because, like, in Project Horizons, Somber really fucking hates the goddess and does everything he can do to, like, discredit her, and in the original story, the goddess is virtually invincible. By the context of the story, like, she is one of the big bads. She is one of the biggest bads in the entire story. She is not something that could just be easily defeated by just shooting her in the head. So it took a nuke to kill her permanently. But the really strange thing that Somber does in this is he discredits the goddess every scene he does, and then acts as if that's canon now. Which kind of launches into, like, a secondary point that I wanted to talk, because also this is when Lacuna dies, and, like, it dies in the stupid, most convoluted way possible, because it's to explain why there was a Twilight Sparkle Alicorn in the original story. But whatever, Lacuna's dead now. And another point I wanted to talk about is the idea of overwriting canon, which is a really common thing that happens in the back half of PH, where at
in hindsight, it's kind of amazing. Like, I can't remember what set me off, but it's kind of amazing in hindsight that this chapter, like, this set of events, wasn't the thing that, like, caused my brain to see into the infinite and create my thesis that the entire story of Project Horizons is a massive act of vandalism.
Yes, it is.
And I think if you could listen back to that episode, for whatever reason, I think I censored this entire section from my mind, even though it is, like, patient zero. It is case positive for my thesis that this isn't a creative act. This is an act of vandalism.
There's a very strange thing that happens in the back half of the story where it's like, at some point, like, I guess Somber started huffing paint and decided that, like, he wrote Fall Equestria, I guess. Like, it's the meme of, like, the you made this, I made this.
I think it's intentional. I don't think it's accidental. I don't think it's huffing paint.
I know. I'm just saying, like, he really, like...
Yeah, I sort of think it would, like, I think he got to this point. I think it's a result of this chapter, because this is, like, roughly the end of Project Horizons. He has now surpassed the canon. He has moved past the point that canon describes. There's probably a bit of fart huffing in that, like, people praising him and apparently being miscategorized as KCAT approved.
Yes,
made him really feel that he was a contributor, like a sincere contributor to the canon. And now that his version of the story, his redaction, his correction of the source material, moved beyond the bounds of the original timeline, that made him the new prime author.
Yeah, he's the true successor of the full Equestria family line. Yeah, but yeah, it's really odd. But, like, so in the case of the goddess, like, he does a lot of stuff where he just rips on the goddess and talks about how lame she is, and then, like, acts as if those that doing that is canon, like, acts as if the, like, his version of the goddess is the only correct one, and therefore, like, going forwards, like, when he rips on the original story, it's this weird thing where it's like, hey, see this dumb straw man? See how dumb and made of straw they are? It's like, but you made it. Like, it says made by Sombra. Like, we can see it. Like, you...
It's kind of interesting. Yeah, I suspect that it's a sort of Thermian argument taking place, but it's amazing when a creator can is willing and eager to make a Thermian argument. And for the audience, a Thermian argument is something the foldable human Dan Olson coined, which is arguing away flaws in the text by citing the text, canon within the text.
Oh, yeah, Thermian argument, yeah.
So, for example, man, it's really gross that Raperella has to rape in order to, like,
gain her
superpowers. Like, that's really kind of a fucked up character concept. A Thermian argument is to go along, well, you see, the god Rapulon is where, like, the planet Rapulon is where she comes from, and that's just how they do it there. And
that's
and
their culture.
And the psychic negative energy of a rape is the only way to gain her dark powers that she uses for righteousness, by the way.
It's the core basis of the Thermian argument, because it's based off of a character in a movie called Galaxy Quest, of which the characters have no concept of fiction and they treat all fiction as fact, and that is essentially what people are doing. Like, it's treating narratives as if they're in a vacuum, and also historical recitation, like
as opposed to inventions.
Yes, as opposed to being made up by a person. Who, you know, lives in a society, but we can't say that because of memes. Like, they are a byproduct of the cultural influences they have. Like, it isn't just invented whole cloth by the work.
They're not reciting a history. They are inventing a fiction. And things that occur within that fiction, the author is... liable for them, is accountable to them.
Yeah, which Sombra thoroughly disagrees with. Reading documentation about it, is Sombra believes in the idea that, like, all decisions they make are only 50% theirs, because the characters speak for themselves, and he can't violate the actions of which they take. But, like, again, here's a little secret for you, Sombra. You made those characterizations up. They're not, those people aren't real. You wrote them that way. So when you write...
Now I'm uncomfortable, because that begins to speak to, like, a pathology.
No, it's in context of the argument that it's in, it's just trying to win an argument by saying that, like...
Oh, yeah.
It's not pathology, it's the, like, I wipe my hands of this thing. Disavowing the actions of their characters by saying that, like, well, I didn't make them that way. That's just the way the story turned out. As if, like, as a writer, they're only, like, sort of like a historian of the events themselves. Like, it's sort of odd. It's a writer who believes in it, like, deeply in the Thermian argument. Like, it's a person who lives the Thermian argument, essentially. They actually seem to believe that, like, they don't have any choice.
They're recounting a history to you.
Yes. That they made up. That's the part they keep forgetting. They invented that. But yeah, it's a confusing mess, to say the least. But yeah, it's frustrating that this overriding canon stuff happens so much, specifically because it worked. The real sad twist of the knife for all of this is that most people consider a lot of the things that happen in Project Horizons to be canon because of a lot of, like, misinformation and, like, broken telephone. You end up a lot with a lot of references to it in other works, and a lot of, like, acceptance that this is things that should have happened, if not out-and-out support of the work, and that sucks, like, a lot. But yeah, we also, there's a lot of other things to talk about. Let me look at the rest of my notes. I also want to talk about the concept of, like, lenses, optics, and the nature of fascism. Because, you know, we kind of can't tiptoe around it a lot in this particular book, because this book was so much about, like, fascist responses to societal collapse and
initially describing a fascist utopia, and then...
Yes.
And then, like, doing a... the gun again, doing Ghostbusters, telling on himself by like winding up exposing a lot of the like lie of his own like utopic claims.
The problem. So the thing about it though is like kind of like why it's still bad. Like why this isn't a genius masterstroke is because ultimately the way like so like the concept of optics, like the idea of like the way something is presented within a work and how it reads contextually is important, and it's also important like what sort of lens you put it through. Like both of us are pretty like lefty boys. Or
liberté, égalité.
Yeah. We're deep in the left weeds, and so like our perspectives are always going to be kind of like tailored and biased by those associations. It can be initially difficult to understand, like, you know, what's the problem with Thunderhead? Like Thunderhead is in the text, the work, the Thunderhead never calls itself a fascist state, and it never behaves like one. It's a utopia built up by just aw shucks, good old Southern boys who just, you know, didn't want to hurt nobody and just want to be left to their own devices. Ignoring the like historical context of that sort of like behavior is often built around like a deep seated sense of resentment towards its neighbors. So it's always important to remember that it's important to remember that the subtext of the work, regardless of intention by the author of something like Thunderhead, is that making an established organization of essentially villains, like stock villains who believe in deep fascism, trying to present them as like a rehabilitated image of like people who were either been like propagandized to not know that like their neighbors to the south of them or below them are not dangerous, and they didn't know anything about it. But like the problem is they still pledge loyalty to the enclave. Like that's the thing. Like the story goes really out of its way to say that like individual enclave states aren't bad. It's only Navarro that's bad because Navarro is the militaristic state. But the problem is that the way the politics of the enclave are presented, Navarro is also the body of power, and Thunderhead doesn't do anything to really countermand that. Even though they are presented with having more than enough ample ability to do so, they still send soldiers off. They still buy in all of the propaganda. There's like a thing that's really telling about this is there's no rebellion. There's no resistance of any kind. Like, you know, typically in these kind of stories, when you see like an empire like this, you sort of have like in stock stories like this, you usually have like some kind of resistance cell or people who are actively fighting against the like
or even historically like German, like it's painfully not told, and I think there's reasons why it's not told, but like leading up to and to a certain degree through the war there was I think it was called White Roses in Germany. Like there were socialist protests. Like there was the Iron Front and White Roses.
Yeah, the Three Arrows or whatever.
Yeah, that's the Iron Front.
Yeah, couldn't remember what it was called.
Who weren't on board?
Yeah,
support for the regime was non-universal.
Yeah, like where are the anarchists? Where are the? It's weird to say, but where are the tankies? Like, where are the violent revolutionary opposition?
Well, weirdly, like they KCAT accounted for them.
Yes,
they were called Dashites.
Yes,
but Somber was super eager to like. There's this weird like brainworm. Like there's this weird like fog in Somber's head where he has to acknowledge that like KCAT established the Dashites. But he does everything he can to downplay them, creating this weird paradox that the government is deeply afraid of Dashites, so much so that they're willing to like make a grotesque display of them with the bleaching. But they don't actually happen. Like they,
yes, and that we never see a single one in Thunderhead.
There's not enough of them to form a political bloc. They are not in fact any kind of threat to the established power to such a degree that like they named parks and major major pieces of civil infrastructure after Rainbow Dash.
Yes.
So, like, it's this weird, like, the disavowal and the cognitive dissonance gets real weird about Dashites during this chapter.
It's very weird also to think about that thanks to K-Cat, Rainbow Dash's cutie mark is now an Antifa symbol. Just want to get that out of there. I mean, it always was. Like Rainbow Dash is the personification of be gay, do crime. So, like, so I think it's more just it's more an inheritance, really, than a direct change. But yeah, but also, like, the nature of fascism. And, like, so, like, I'm not a political science, political theory person. I'm an idiot who draws porn on the internet. So I'm gonna probably get, like, a lot of the more specifics about, like, how fascism do wrong, but, like, the general term for, like, a general understanding of it is, what's the word I'm looking for? It's, like, ultra-nationalist populism, I think is the term that sometimes is used for...
The thing about fascism is that it's inherently, and in many cases, intentionally incoherent. There's a couple major red flags for if you're dealing with some fascism. The number one, I think the thing that's immediately spring to mind, there's a fancy term for it that's escaping me, but resurrected glory is the core theme of any fascist regime. We are going back to the golden age. Yeah. There is a mythical golden age that we have strayed from.
Oh, prelapsarianism.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's another term for it, but I'm thinking of something else. But yes, prelapsarian.
I just like saying prelapsarianism. It's
yeah. There was a time when all was great, and we shall return to it again.
The South will rise again, et cetera, et cetera.
We will not Golden be Dawn Party of Greece. Mussolini's Italy is where the term fascism really got started, because it caught you, like, the name is drawn from the Roman fascis.
Yeah, the weird, like, stick axe thing. Yeah.
Which is the idea that, which is basically Hobbes's Leviathan in the form of an axe covered with sticks, is that, yes, we're all into this together, but you are all extensions of the Führer's will.
And if one of you breaks, it doesn't matter. It's only if the whole thing breaks.
And by the whole thing, we just mean the axe in the middle. You will pile on and make the axe the center of the fascies indestructible.
Yes.
Which is the glorious leader. So it's ultra authoritarian. It is
ultra nationalist.
It's ultra nationalist. So I think that's I think that's the core, like, defining trait of fascism. After that is the friend enemy distinction. Is the need to define one's in group by one's enemies.
Yes.
That there is always an out group. There's always an internal enemy that has to be rooted out. The one of the core theses of the two core theses of fascism, most likely, are one, we have to return to the glory days, and two, in order to do that, we have to root out the other. We must kill the other. So long as an other exists, we will never be safe. And that's really highlighted at the end of this book, in the Thunderhead chapter, is that over and over again, the existing thesis of Thunderhead and Lighthoof's big plan for it is to eradicate all others.
Yes.
Is to erase the outside world forever.
But yeah, so it's important to remember all of these things going forwards with Thunderhead, that, like, the Enclave in general believes in a lot of these things, and it's God. I've described Thunderhead as being, like, very neoliberal in its kind of fascism, like, it's liberal fascism to a T. Jack Saint did a great video on Sky High, which is kind of ironic that everything involves flying buildings with these people. About the idea of liberal fascism, where it's basically just fascism without all the skulls, is the way I always look at it as. It's we keep all of the same political structures, we've just done away with, like, the bad imagery that's associated with us. Because in the case of, like Thunderhead is, like, the pinnacle of neoliberalism to me, because it is still a fascist dictatorship where, like, characters have almost no political power outside of the counselors, to the point where Thunderhead collapses the moment people start killing counselors. Like that was the thing that we never really touched on during the episode, but like Dawn killed a single counselor and it put the whole city so in disarray that the whole of their government collapsed because no one else has a political power. The concept that there are poor is ridiculous to me in the Thunderhead, that like this utopia still includes like unfair hierarchy is odd to me. But the where like it really sort of shines into neoliberalism is that it's only contrary to fascism that it presents is it's just more diverse than other places. But even then, its diversity is very hollow because it just means that it has like, because it has unicorns and earth ponies, but like the earth ponies can't leave the stable because they can't use the magic that allows them to step on clouds by themselves. And unicorns are like, not really like a protected class, but more like a, what am I looking for as like a term? Like they're a class of gifted workers but are still treated
administrative.
Yeah. But like, but they're not as administrative. Like they make sure like all the magic of the city runs, but they themselves don't have any rights. They're like,
no, I mean that kind of does fit like the administrative class or house slaves.
Okay, that's
what they're well treated. They're well fed, but at the end of the day, they do not have human rights.
Yeah,
they're just a more expensive kind of slave.
Yeah, at the end of the day, the collar slips back around the neck, and like that's still presented as like a promising alternative to the Enclave. But like, that really just comes down to the problem with liberalism, is that it presents the idea that, like, this is the best we have, and we should be, like, happy with that. Like, the best we got is
diversity. We should be grateful it isn't worse.
Yeah, like, diversity and slavery is the best we got. It's like, we have a more diverse roster of dictators is the best liberalism can offer us. You get to choose what color your senile old rapist is when you vote. You should be thankful for that alone. So, like, it's very odd because this is, like, Thunderhead is almost, like, is comically because of its size. Because it's also, it's important to remember there's 70,000 people here, which is, like, at least 10 times the population of the rest of the wasteland. Is that, like, the Thunderhead is, like, the shining crown of civilization. The closest we have is, like, society, which also has its own problems. Like, we've talked about society a lot in its own chapter. It's just slavery apologism. But, like, Thunderhead is like the shining crown of civilization, and the best it can come up with is kill our, like, we don't kill unicorns, we just put them to work.
Slaves are very well treated, very well fed. They're practically family.
Yeah, but they have no rights.
Now, I think the ultimate punchline of Thunderhead is like, look at this like beautiful social cohesion. Like the look at this beautiful pristine place cut off from outside influences. Yeah. And how well they work together and trust each other innately. The shit hits the fan even a little bit. Then Navarro, like, people find out Navarro's launching an attack. Boom! Social cohesion obliterated. Like, yes. everyone, they immediately start tearing each other apart.
They immediately start eating each other.
Which really, like, yeah, no simmering tension there. No underlying resentments in that society. No, sir.
No, sorry, Bob. Especially because, like, the comical... there's, like, a sequence in it where Blackjack is being helped by a bunch of pick a side that are just like, oh, we're just big old neighbors. We all love each other. We just want to help each other out. And then, like, later that chapter, everyone's eating each other. I got a couple more points we can really get through.
Yeah, no, let's hit your notes because we don't have like a chapter from Sombard as a guiding light for our format. So it's all on you, Mo.
We definitely need to talk about the concept of sacrifice at some point. But I want to get up to I do want to talk about like my point, which I just called the absence of glory. Which is just the fact that, like, she's just not in the story. she's just gone. Like, she, despite the fact that, like, this is her home turf. This is the
place. That's actually a refrigerator.
This is her home turf. She's been living here her entire life at this point. She has proven herself to be at least a somewhat okay combatant, and a gifted doctor and all sorts of amazing things, and she does nothing this chapter. She's always like this, but it's so much more stark in its contrast how little Sombra gives a fuck about this character and wants her gone. Like apparently the plan, like I talked about this before maybe, but like talking about it now, the plan was always supposed to be that Glory was supposed to bite it, or she was supposed to be exempt from the story and come back here, because she was supposed to be replaced by her sister, which is why her sister shows up in the final chapter of book one. But she was a fan favorite, so Sombra was obliged to keep her in, but had nothing for her to do. That's why there's a conversation we have really, really early in. We're baffled by the fact that BJ is like on all of the drugs and she's coming down really hard, and instead of Glory being the one to like nurse her back to health, Rampage is the source of medical knowledge in the group, and how we were just
that happens
so
a couple times. Like
yes, it does.
Blackjack is in need of a doctor. Where are we gonna find one of those?
Dr. Blackjack will help. Or just like Dr. Rampage will help. And she, and it's because there's been this thing, like Glory is essentially like a four-dimensional object. She has been existing in the fridge the entire time because he just doesn't write any, he writes no lines for her. He has nothing for her to do. The only thing she does is become Rainbow Dash and have sex with Blackjack. That's all she does. She has no critical importance to the story. And it's just a bummer. Like, it's also the fact that like Glory's like, it's also like really, really obvious to me in hindsight how telling this was that Glory, even now, even after Thunder had imploded, like literally imploded, Glory still kind of believes in the Enclave.
Amazing.
She learned nothing.
Amazing. Amazing. You've done a no growth.
It's sort of impressive. I'm just definitely blown away by her utter lack of relevance to the story. That it's incredible, and the fact that she just has no arc. Like no one has any arc, but Glory doesn't have an arc because Sombra doesn't think there's a problem with the idea of believing in fascism. Essentially, because in Sombra's mind, that Thunderhead isn't fascist. They're liberal, I guess. But I mean, like that's the same thing to me in this case because like they're liberals who still buy into fascist ideology.
I mean, recent history is pretty well exposed how, like, mainstream liberals are not meaningfully distinct from conservatives.
Yes. Something-something fuck establishment Dems.
Something-something blue MAGA.
Oh, that's a good one. It's the player two palette swap.
Yeah.
That's what the Democrats are. They're the Ken of politics. No, they're the Dan Hibiki of politics. Because they can't do anything right.
Nope.
But anyways, also, I guess this also gives me an opportunity to talk about, like, it's wild to me that, Sombra made Rainbow Dash a traitor, like not a traitor to her people, but a traitor to her ideology. She is the only characterization we were ever given of her really in this story is that she fucking hated the Enclave because they refused to do anything in a time of crisis, and then she went missing.
That's what caused my brain to snap. Was the oh yeah, here's Rainbow Dash, and she believes in what I believe.
Yes,
she hates you, Dash Eyes.
Yes, it's Karl Marx was a loser.
I'm Peter Pop-Tart. What's his name? Yes, my name, Peter Pop-Tart, and Marx was a bad individual marketplace of
ideas.
Communities bad.
I don't know. I'm just thinking of like that
worker
like
bad
Captain America Hail Hydra thing, but it's just got like Karl Marx's face like superimposed over it. That's making me laugh.
Yeah, no,
it's Captain America going Hail Hydra. It's such a like, it's so maddening. It's just, oh, here's the symbol of your revolution. they work for me now. And that she was like more or less okay with like the like also specifically, she was more or less okay with the surface being bleached with a zombie virus.
Yeah, that's one of the things that really, I don't know how well I communicated in the episode, but I was pretty fucking thrown by, but Rainbow Dash, what about the bioweapon missiles? Oh, don't worry, that their contents won't affect anyone up here. Wait, what?
Who are you? Like, I wanted her to pull off her skin. It was like, no, I also got turned to Rainbow Dash by Killing Joke. I'm just Light Hooves again. Yeah, that scene is like the fact that she like became she sold out and became Batman at the same time, and she was willing to sacrifice the surface for a better, more utopic enclave is like such a bad take. Like, it's such a bad interpretation of the character of RBD, both the show's version and the Fall Equestria version. But yeah, I think I'm almost sort of out of points I can really talk about that I think of. The one last one I can really get into is a core thesis of this story. Sorry, you're cutting out a little bit there, so I wasn't sure what you're saying. But a core thesis of this story is the idea of useful sacrifice. This is something I touched on like literally books ago in a previous book review, but it's more present in this one is. Because it's the core thing, that's the core difference between Blackjack and Light Hooves, is the idea that there is such a thing as useful suicide versus useless suicide.
Okay.
It presents the difference between it as if there's the idea that like you can sacrifice yourself in a way that has merit towards society, and that's good. Because, you know, so like suicidal ideation is a fucking like nightmare and like damage your sense of your importance to society. Anyways, the reality of how it's presented, like there's some post, like there, like it's something that we're gonna have to get to at some point. Somber once just straight up told people what the theme of his story was, like what the plot, like more or less, like he did a recitation of the entire plot and then just explained all of the themes of it, which is already pretty hacky in and of itself. But like, one of the big things he always touched on was the idea that like the story is meant to be about making useful sacrifices because, and this is the fucking stupidest thing in the world to me. Like, I'm definitely going to read it all out loud. Maybe next book.
Yeah. That's the end of next book.
The thing I want to include that's really important is that the Jesus allegory that we've been alluding to about Blackjack is deliberate. She is meant to have died for your sins and came back more pure so that she could become a person who sacrifices herself for the good of all mankind. That's her purpose.
It's really funny he thinks that, because that's what that to us, that is a joke.
Yes,
that is a joke. That is intensely funny to us. we were mocking you, Somber. You probably shouldn't.
Yeah, like, one of the most hacky stories in the world you could possibly do is I made my character a Jesus allegory, and to just come out and say that, like, oh no, I made my character a Jesus allegory is sort of incredible. Like, it's a lack of self-awareness I didn't know possible. But in this story, it presents the idea that the difference between BJ and I almost call him Thunderhead, but Light Hooves, Ledger Domain, is that
Mr. Thunderhead. Thunderhead Esquire.
Yes. He is that they both want to self-destruct. And a absolute worrying, nightmarish ideology that the story presents, like a genuinely mental illness as ideology that the story presents, is the idea that suicide is okay as long as it's useful to society to do, and that there's such a thing as a difference between self-destructive and suicide, which there is no, like, as far as I'm concerned, like, I'm sure a therapist can really back me up on this, there really is no observable difference between self-destruction and suicide. Like, if you throw yourself in the front of a car, it doesn't matter why you did it.
Yeah, is suicide ideation in politics. So there's another, Umberto Eco's pointed this out, it's a pretty common common thing to point out is one of the recurring themes in sort of fascist ideology is the cult of heroism. Yes. is the death drive mode of politics, where everyone is expected to be a potential martyr at all times. Like martyrdom for the greater glory is such a core aspect of fascism. One of the earliest groups to have to accept that title, the Spanish fascists under Franco, their motto was viva la muerte, long live death.
Yes.
And so this is, I'm actually kind of surprised this is the first time it's fully actually occurred to me, because this has come up a few times. We've had to stop and talk about good suicide. You shouldn't just waste your death selfishly. You should bottle it and save it for an opportunity to be martyred. And in fact, everyone should. It's a sign of good moral character that you're excited to die. You're eager to die. But the only question is making sure that it's a good and exciting and politically effective death.
Yeah, there's a weirdly enough, there's a quote in Fall Equestria that comes to mind that is also refuted by Fall Equestria, in which there's a part in which Lil Pip describes that if it would be enough for her to die killing the wasteland herself, if it meant other people could live a happier life. And there's a later part where all of her friends tell her she's an idiot for believing that. that there's no such thing as a person worth sacrificing. Because for a complicated reason, she considers herself to be, collateral damage to, defeat the Enclave or something. We'll get into it, when we actually do the book, but... there is a scene where they refute the core premise, I guess, Project Horizons is built upon, which is the idea that BJ only has value in death as a death dealer herself, as an executioner, despite her efforts to make the point that she's not as a killer, as a
her being increasingly of gun. Hollow disavowal.
Yes, as a being of gun, as a praised be to gun. As the second coming of Gunn, she's fine with dying herself to fix everything, and that's painted as being morally justified and
noble,
also
and valid.
Yeah, that she should martyr and burn herself out on the rack of the wheel of progress, so that society can be made anew from her destruction. And I don't know, that's super not healthy. And yeah, it's very fashy to just believe that there is a martyr class, essentially. That's effectively how the right treats the soldiers. Like they only care about
and
soldiers.
All workers, you exist to die. Your job is to die. If you take your life yourself, well, that's destruction of property.
Yes.
You squandered a perfectly good death.
Yes. So
it's grim stuff, and I think that's probably where we should leave it. Is the sort of the culmination and pointing of for this book recap.
Hey, I was gonna say, is there
any strange?
Is there any points you want to make before we go?
No. My core one was the big takeaway from this book is it contains a chapter in it that is the ultimate epitome of proof. Look, you fools. My thesis that this doesn't constitute a normal creative act. This is an act of vandalism. This is attempting to paint over someone else's work and take credit for somebody else's labor.
I think the only other thing I can think of off the top of my head is I kind of wanted to sort of ask where do you think we're going next? Where is this going?
Okay. that's almost impossible to answer because, like, it's so much detritus, and I don't know what Sombra's media diet from, like, week to week was during the writing of this, because don't another thing we also found out, we got some deep lore. It turns out I was exactly right on the cast, that the chapter that Blackjack became Mr. Ed 209 came out around the time that the most recent RoboCop reboot hit theaters. So I have no idea what fucking Sombra's, like, media diet has been. We no longer have it being a hollow pantomime of the original story to go on. All I can guess is that they are going to finally go into the core.
Yeah.
We're probably going to have a microwave hallway 2.0. And if we don't, I'm going to be sort of confused about that.
But yeah, I just kind of wanted to see, like, what... I think it'd be... I just kind of thought it'd be fun to try and get some predictions to see, like, how many, like...
Yeah.
How many we get right.
Been slightly spoiled because, like, one of the core, like, I can't not be spoiled that eventually they go to the moon. They go to the moon. The moon rocket will either be provided by Spike or inexplicably be in Hoofington Center, Hoofington Square.
It's just a rocket there the whole time.
Yeah,
that's pretty funny.
That maybe the reactor just is a rocket, that, like, I don't know. No, I'm starting to get too creative. You see, like, I have to think like a dullard. And I also have to know exactly what his media diet was, like, week to week. So, yeah. Like, yeah, that's the best I got. I know that they're going down into the core, and they'll eventually go to the moon. Maybe they'll fight their way to the moon. There'll be big space battles from there to the moon. Or otherwise, just really boring conversation chapters on the rocket from point A to point B. That's all I got.
All right, just kind of wanted to. Oh, I thought it'd be fun to just see, like, hey, let's just try to ruminate on, like, what's going to happen next. But to give people some hope for next book.
I predict either, like, it'll be there'll be either a slow aggravating microwave hallway, or I'll be really mad and irritated because, like, it kind of contradicts a lot of stuff that there wouldn't be a microwave hallway. Yeah, that's my prediction. I'm going to be upset in one of two ways. involving the presence or lack of.
But yeah, that's so look forward to that next week, folks.
You know what we could be doing instead? Playing One Step from Eden.
That's pretty good.
Hey, kids, do you like Mega Man Battle Network? Are you too young to know what that series of words are? Check it out anyway. It's a fun roguelike that has it's extremely cute. The graphic design is really amazing, and the devs really care about the product. That, like, it's already on sale, and they've probably made their money at this point, but they're still adding updates to make it more user-friendly. And that's this week's recommendation. Besides that, if you're slightly horned, you can go to Thou Art Fine.
I do have a recommendation as well that I don't want to make. I want to recommend also a game that I picked up very recently called Bug Fables. It's like Bug Fables, The Legend of the Everlasting Sapling or something like that. It's Paper Mario. Like, they just remade Paper Mario, but with bugs. And it's adorable.
Oh, I think I heard about that.
Yeah, it's very cute. It's got a very cute aesthetic. It's, if you're someone like me who, like, grew up on Paper Mario games and really wish that, like, they didn't suck now, then, like, Bug Fables is definitely up your alley. It's very cute. I like the characters. The main character is a bee who has a boomerang. And when you get enough hits on one of her attacks, it says unbelievable. So that's really where the humor is. It's very charming, but yeah, if you want to find us and you are horned up and or mad about politics and smoke screens and discourse, then you can come to my Twitter, which is @thouartfi. If you're not as interested in those things and are more interested,
if you're interested in random, like, currently this is what my Twitter @weirdingtone is. cute animals, reblogging art that I think is cool, mostly from like concept artists broadly and comic artists. So cute animals and art. And if you look at my replies, just the deepest, angriest vitriol.
And same.
I fucking had libs. Like, it's really bad. I should probably pin one of my latest, like, actually proper tweets saying that, like, a while back, earlier this year, I was planning to start a solo podcast discussing how we can find the spiritual tools to move beyond hate and forgive our enemies. For most of them know not what they do. And we can't, it's going to be very hard to bring them over if we just are consumed with murderous rage. And perhaps we can use sort of like tools of like brain hacks and superstition to try and like wean ourselves off of just sheer apocalyptic rage. And now goes the tweet. But now I think I've switched my political affiliation to anarcho-thanocracy. Political alignment that calls for the eradication of all life.
You have become an anime supervillain. And I, on the other hand, have always been an anarcho-communist, so I have never believed in the idea that government, like, can work anyways as it is, and I've always felt that it needed to be teared down anyway, so, like, while I'm not an accelerationist, because I think that hurts people, you know, I think about the fact that your political voting options are basically one bad person or the other bad person, and that, like, fuck you if you keep pushing for vote blue. You're a bastard who doesn't believe in the idea of, like, anything. Like, you have no convictions. You just want to win.
At this point, I think the most generous thing, like, I'm done talking about elections, period. I'm just, like, my stance is to just, I'm not discussing it. It's beneath me. I think it's beneath you. I believe in you, whoever you are, more than that. It is electoral politics is over. We can have them back when we have a system that we can trust to actually count our votes. In the meantime, volunteer, do things to improve the material conditions around you. Voting is not going to change anything.
Volunteer and organize.
You can write in your own cat for president for all that an election is going to change anything in your environment. You have to do that.
Yes.
Yourself. With your money, your time, like your energy, like do something in your community. Help build a community around you. Wherever possible, try and look online for resources toward that. Make a Facebook group, anything. We're going to have to figure it out, and we're going to have to do it together. Elected politicians are not going to do this for us.
Yes.
So that said, how many more books do we have left?
We got one more. We're almost done.
Oh, I don't want to.
we got to push through.
Fine. Fy, I don't wanna. This has all been a terrible mistake.
But I couldn't come home in the dark.